Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 13. Bahugana converses with Jad Bharat. Text 7. Shurai. Kritasva. Kvacha. Nirvina. Cheta, Shochan, Vimuyan, Payati, Kashmalam, Kvachit, Cha, Kandarvapuram, Kavishta, Kamodate, Nirvritavat, Muhurtam, Surairitasva, Pachanirvinacheta, Shochan Vimoyan Upayati Kashmalam Vachit Chagandar Vapuram Pravishta Pramodate Nirvritavan Muhurtam. Surai.
By very powerful enemies.
Kritasva. All of whose possessions have been stolen. Kvacha. Sometimes. Nirvina cheta. Very morose and aggrieved at heart. Shochan. Deeply lamenting.
Vimuyan.
Becoming bewildered.
Upayati.
Achieves.
Kashmalam.
Unconsciousness.
Kvachit.
Sometimes. Cha. Also.
Kandarvapuram.
An imaginary city in the forest. Pravishta. Having entered. Pramodate.
He enjoys.
Nirvritavat. Exactly like a person who has achieved success.
Muhurtam.
For a moment only. Translation. Sometimes, being defeated or plundered by a superior, powerful agent, a living entity loses all his possessions. He then becomes very morose, lamenting their loss, and he sometimes becomes unconscious. Sometimes he imagines a great palatial city in which he desires to live happily with his family members and riches. He thinks himself fully satisfied if this is possible, but such so-called happiness continues only for a moment. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The word Kandarvapuram is very significant in this verse. Sometimes in the forest, a very big castle appears, and this is called a castle in the air. Actually, this castle does not exist anywhere but in one's imagination. This is called Gandharvapur. In the material forest, the conditioned soul sometimes contemplates great castles and skyscrapers, and he wastes his energy for such things, hoping to live in them very peacefully with his family forever. However, the laws of nature do not allow this. When he enters such castles, he temporarily thinks that he is very happy, even though his happiness is impermanent. His happiness may last for a few years, but because the owner of the castle has to leave the castle at the time of death, everything is eventually lost. This is the way of worldly transactions. Such happiness is described by Vidyapati as the happiness one derives upon seeing a drop of water in the desert. The desert is heated by scorching sunshine, and if we want to reduce the desert temperature, we need huge amounts of water, millions and millions of gallons. What effect will one drop have? Water certainly has value, but one drop of water cannot reduce the heat of the desert. In this material world, everyone is ambitious, but the heat is very scorching. What will an imaginary castle in the air do to help? Srila Vidyapati has therefore sung Tatala Saikate Vari Bindu Sama Sutta Mita Ramani Samaje. The happiness of family life, friends, and society is compared to a drop of water in the scorching heat desert. The entire material world is busy trying to attain happiness because happiness is the prerogative of the living being. Unfortunately, due to falling in contact with the material world, the living entity simply struggles for existence. Even if one becomes happy for a while, a very powerful enemy may plunder everything. There are many instances in which big businessmen suddenly become paupers in the street. If the nature of material existence is such that foolish people are attracted to these transactions and they forget the real business of self-realization. Translation again. Sometimes being defeated or plundered by a superior, powerful agent, the living entity loses all his possessions. He then becomes very morose, and lamenting their loss, he sometimes becomes unconscious. Sometimes he imagines a great palatial city in which he desires to live happily with his family members and riches. He thinks himself fully satisfied if this is possible, but such so-called happiness continues only for a moment. We all of us live in a material body, and the body itself is compared to a city of 9 gates. The gates are 2 eyes, 2 nostrils, 2 ears, the mouth, and so on. And however much we are enjoying life within that city, we will have to leave the city, we'll have to leave the body, and everything associated with it. But none of us want to leave the body. None of us want to leave the things that give pleasure to us in the body. And therefore, when we are forced to separate from them, we suffer. Therefore, instead of being so attached to the body and the things that give happiness to the body and mind, we should rather develop our relationship with something permanent. In other words, with Krishna. A deeper problem is that we are not the body. We are spirit souls, and as such, we have no real relationship with the body. Our real relationship is with the Supreme Soul, or Krishna. Now, the image of the city in the air, something that exists just for a short while, pertains not only to the body and the life we create around the body, but it actually applies to the whole creation. The whole universe exists just for a short time compared to eternity. And certainly the present civilization will exist only for a few years more, according to some predictions. Just before, in fact, I actually left His Holiness Devamrita Swami in my little ashram to come here. I actually left before he did. But in any case, he spent some time with us, and he gave a talk in which he read from an article from a journal from MIT. The article reviewed a book by an author who made some predictions about the future of modern civilization as we know it, when the oil runs out. Now, there seems to be common consensus amongst authorities, scientific authorities, that the oil will run out. It's just a matter of when. And the predictions range, 10 years, 30 years, 60 years. But there's common agreement that the supply of oil in the earth will run out. And the author of the book under review predicted that when it does, modern civilization as we know it will come to an end. He said that the alternative energy sources, such as solar energy or even hydroelectric energy, will not be sufficient to maintain the present level of civilization as we know it. And he gave some insights into what life would be like in the future after the supply of oil runs out. Basically, people will go back to the condition of life before the creation of this petroleum-driven civilization. They will have to travel on foot, or I guess by bicycle. For example, if we were to travel from where we are now to downtown Dallas, it would probably be a whole day's journey there and back. To travel to Denton would probably be a 3-day journey there and back. And Houston would probably be 8 to 10 days. Petroleum products are everywhere. The asphalt roads themselves are made of petroleum. So the author predicted that, you know, in time, this wonderful maze of highways that we've created would gradually turn to rubble. And even the solar cells, the solar panels, they're made on a plastic framework, which comes from petroleum. So we just imagine life without not just liquid petroleum, but all the byproducts, all, you know, plastic and so on. Things would be very different. And anyway, you get the picture. He predicted that pirates would come from other countries by ship to plunder, you know, whatever little resources we had. He predicted they'd come from Japan and places like that, come to California and plunder whatever, you know, riches were there. And everything that, you know, pretty much everything that we've invested our energy into would be lost. Now, anyone who hears this prediction and is aware of some of Srila Prabhupada's statements, of course his predictions were not necessarily based on the petroleum running out, although he was aware of the possibility. In fact, on one morning walk in Los Angeles, he, you know, some devotee mentioned how people were worried. Of course, I think people then were more conscious than people now. It seems that people now just want to plunder the resources of the earth and just enjoy them until they run out and not even worry about the future. But then, as one devotee mentioned, people were concerned that in the future there would be no petroleum to run the automobiles of their children, grandchildren. And, you know, Srila Prabhupada said, you know, they're so worried about what's going to happen to their grandchildren, you know, that they won't have gas to drive their cars. And meanwhile, they're not thinking they may be riding in the car as a cockroach. They may take birth as a cockroach and be riding in the back of the car. They're not thinking about that. They're not worried about that. But at least, you know, they're thinking of their grandchildren, which seems to be better than some people today. And Srila Prabhupada advised us to create, you know, self-sufficient farm communities in preparation for such an eventuality, so that we're prepared. No one else will be prepared because they don't want to believe that such a calamity is going to take place. And in fact, Devamrita Swami commented on this American optimism. You know, this American optimism. You know, we'll get through it. You know, we'll find some solution. You know, we'll go ahead. And he said that is very American, but it's not universal. You know, he preaches in Russia, and they don't have that attitude there at all. In Russia, their attitude is life is miserable, and somehow we just have to survive. That's all. And as far as like, they can't understand why Americans get so, you know, involved in the political campaigns and the elections, because their attitude is, we don't really care who comes into power, because we know whoever it is, they're just going to oppress us and plunder us. And, you know, it seemed to be maybe heading in that direction. In India, after Indira Gandhi declared the emergency and assumed, you know, totalitarian powers, that was also a fascinating story. Even Srila Prabhupada was fascinated by it, because, like, at a certain stage, he would have the devotees read him the newspaper about it. That we'll come to that. But anyway, so, you know, she put all her political enemies in jail, and she basically assumed absolute power. She declared a state of emergency. And on the basis of the state of emergency, she assumed absolute powers. So, of course, everyone was flattering her and, you know, obeying her. So she fell into the illusion that people liked her. Oh, boy, people like me. So she thought, well, we can remove the state of emergency and call for elections. And in the elections, she was defeated, because actually people hated her. But they had no choice but to flatter her and obey her. So after the elections, people were jubilant. You know, the Janata Party won, and, you know, the old freedom fighters, and Morarji Desai and Jay Prakash Narayan, and people. And Prabhupada commented, they're jubilant, you know. The lion is gone, the lion is gone. But they don't know that in place of the lion, they have a tiger. And even here, you know, after the last election, when so many friends were so upset, even devotees who aren't that political, but they were upset, very upset, because they didn't like the result, and they weren't even sure that the result was gained by legitimate means. So there were like a lot of messages on the internet, even in the devotee community. And by chance or luck, I just came across a quotation from Srila Prabhupada where he says that somehow or other, demons capture the vote and assume the highest position in the land. They plunder the people and divide up the money amongst themselves and their friends. That is democracy. again, it seemed to ring so true. I mean, it was just unbelievable. It was as if he had, you know, had assessed the present situation and made the statement. So Srila Prabhupada's perception of things was so deep, and he was actually so far ahead of his time that, you know, only as time goes on do people appreciating him. And I think we will come to appreciate his vision of the future, that we do need to be prepared. We need to grow our own food. We have to be prepared to travel by, you know, bullock carts or ox carts. We have to be prepared to light lamps with castor oil and so on. You know, people thought that his ideas were backwards, but actually his ideas were very futuristic. He wasn't behind the times, he was actually ahead of the time. So anyway, after reading some quotations from the book in the article, then he read what the commentators on the book, the reviewers of the book from MIT said. And they came through with this American optimism, which is really, it's like a religion. There's no evidence for it at all. There's absolutely no evidence. But anyway, and with the American optimism, the reviewer said that he thinks that this is a very dark picture, that yes, it's true that the oil probably will run out, but, you know, the human capacity for ingenuity and intelligence and creativity will prevail. It's just like a completely faith-based statement. That's all. He said, you know, we will muddle through it. You know, whatever it is, I have faith, we will muddle through it. But then he made some very perceptive comments, although he mentioned them, by the way, to make a different point. But if we take the comments as stated by him, they're actually quite profound in terms of the material world. He was saying that we live in fear. We live in constant fear of our own inventions. Now that I could relate to. I mean, if anyone is sort of a little sober, he or she will know we do live in constant fear of our own. Just, you know, driving on the highway, we're in fear that we're going to be hit by a car, we're going to hit something, go off the road, or whatever. And what to speak of you know, air travel. And I mean, we hope nothing will happen, but there's always a chance. And then now there's the added fear of terrorists and suicide bombs and others of our own inventions. And then he said that since Hiroshima, referring to the dropping of the atomic bomb, that since Hiroshima we have lived in fear that we will die by our own hand. And that's so true. Of course, then he says, you know, it hasn't happened and blah, 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 we'll go on. But whatever happens, you know, whether the oil runs out in 30 years or 60 years or whatever, the fact is that we have created a civilization that's full of fear and anxiety. Everyone is afraid. And all these laws or whatever. I mean, you just don't know what might happen. So whatever the particular outcome of the limited supply of oil and the seemingly endless demand for its consumption. The fact remains that we've created a civilization in which people are full of fear and anxiety. According to the latest survey, the most prevalent disease worldwide after heart disease is depression. I mean, what kind of a civilization have we created? We're killing ourselves. Even if we don't kill ourselves in the most gross, literal way, we're killing our spirits. And it's really a terrible situation. And I mean, it sounds like a fanatical statement or something, a cliche, but when you actually get down to it, some spiritual approach to life is really the only hope. I mean, I'm reminded of the title that Srila Prabhupada gave to our last Pandal program. I mean, his last Pandal program in Bombay. The modern civilization is a failure. The only hope is Krishna consciousness. Now, that's a very bold statement. And under Prabhupada's direction, we have like this huge band right across the front of the Pandal, you know, on one of the main streets of downtown Bombay. The modern civilization is a failure. The only hope is Krishna consciousness. And it's true. It was as true then as it is now, but it seems more obvious now than it was then. And therefore, it's sort of a paradox that some people think that what Srila Prabhupada said then is no longer relevant now, because it's actually more relevant now. I mean, it was always relevant, but he was so far ahead of his time that it's taken us 30 years or whatever to start to realize more of the truth of what he said then. And a lot of what he said then was just based on, you know, spiritual vision. Now there are all sorts of studies analyzing the material world and proving that, you know, the modern civilization is bound to fail. It can't continue the way. So, you know, we've been warned, like they say, to be warned is to be forearmed. We've been warned. And so we can prepare. But of course, the main preparation, the best preparation, or ultimately the only preparation, is to be Krishna conscious. And, you know, those who can stay in the cities, preach, distribute books, teach, you know, that's the best service. But otherwise, if you know, devotees are more sort of in the mode or in the stage of life where they need to maintain themselves and, you know, take care of their families, which is natural. You know, it can be done in such a way that we don't forget the goal of life. You know, that the goal of Krishna consciousness remains prominent. And the other things, temporary things, are seen in their proper perspective as things that we have to do, but it's not our real goal. And even, I think, after Katrina, I mean, all these disasters, but as I recall, after Katrina, people were saying that they were cut off from food supplies. And it was just so obvious how, not only artificial, but how dangerous the system of having food transported with the help of petroleum-driven vehicles is. Yeah. People couldn't get food. You know, they were starving. They were right in the middle of New Orleans in the whatever their stadium was. Superdome. Yeah. In the Superdome. And they were starving. So it's not very helpful. The signs are there, all these disasters, they're showing us. So we have, by Srila Prabhupada's grace, we have knowledge, absolute spiritual knowledge, but even knowledge of the material nature, like Vishu Upanishad says, we should know the process of nescience and the process of knowledge side by side. And we, you know, yes, we can save ourselves by becoming Krishna conscious, and we should. But we can also help others. And that was also a very special feature of Srila Prabhupada and Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, the idea of reforming the world. I had a nice talk with our godbrother Pradyumna Prabhu, who was Srila Prabhupada's Sanskrit editor. And Pradyumna Prabhu is he's very learned, and at the same time he's very neutral. Whenever I asked him a question, I felt I was getting a neutral answer. He didn't have any agenda or any axe to grind. And so I was asking him about, you know, what previous acharyas had written and how Srila Prabhupada drew upon it and so on. And he said that Srila Prabhupada's commentaries are unique because they take, you know, eternal spiritual principles and relate them to, you know, contemporary practical difficulties. But no acharya ever did that. You know, if you look at Prabhupada's teachings or writings, just the whole, you know, spiritual commune, like all these contemporary issues, you know, life comes from light. Prabhupada addressed them. And he did so on the basis of eternal spiritual principles, Vedic knowledge. So this is our twofold mission: to become Krishna conscious, to be very strong in our spiritual practices, and to help others to be strong in our conviction of the value of Krishna consciousness, and to convince others. Try to convince others. So it's like sometimes the apocalyptic Christians, they say, like, the end is near. The end is near, the end is near. So I think as far as oil goes, it seems that the end is near. And it may be that the end of all of this phantasmagoria of highways and skyscrapers that may also come to a close. So we should be prepared spiritually and in every way. Anyway, Hare Krishna. Keshava Bharati is Goswami Maharaja.
Thank you very much. discuss with him how we can actually, conserve it and grow it. What takes place in that last statement?
Yes, faith. Ado Shraddha. First comes Shraddha, faith and attraction. And the entire process of bhakti is really the development of faith. Prema is really just faith in its fully matured state. So all these different stages from Shraddha to Prema are really just different degrees of strengthening and intensifying of faith. Now, faith begins by association. I won't go into all the scriptural references, but the idea is that by associating with devotees and hearing the messages of Krishna from them, one develops faith. And that faith is nurtured in the association of devotees. And therefore the association of devotees is most important. At the same time, the association of non-devotees is forbidden, and I'll explain exactly what that means. But because they don't have faith in bhakti, they have faith in karma or jnana or, in modern terms, science, economic development, sense gratification. If our faith is weak and we associate too much with them, then, instead of us bringing them to Krishna consciousness, they can bring us to their position. So we find throughout the scriptures, glorification of associating with devotees, sadhu sangha, sarva siddhi bhoy. And rejection of the association of non-devotees, asat samtyaga e vaishnava chara. So association and practical application of the principles of Krishna consciousness are the way to keep faith. If you receive an instruction, say, chant 16 rounds of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra without offense every day, and if you follow it, and feel the results as you will, if you do follow, then your faith will increase. Your faith will increase. But if you don't follow, if you don't chant your rounds, or if you chant but you don't really try to avoid the offenses when you chant, you won't get the same result. And so your faith may become weaker. So these two things are essential, that we follow the process properly and we associate with others who have faith in the process. Follow it. And then we will develop strong conviction. And like Prabhupada said, unless you're convinced, how will you be able to convince others? In one letter to me, there's a whole background to it, but in one letter to me, Srila Prabhupada wrote, I guess I have to give a little of the background. I was in Madras and I was preaching just as I had heard Srila Prabhupada preach. And I discovered, friends told me, well-wishers told me, that there was an undercurrent of protest against the way I was preaching. People didn't like the fact that I was insisting that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and that you know, Brahma, Shiva, Durga, Ganesh, and others were his servants. And they didn't like the fact that I was saying that bhakti is the only way to realize God, you know, not karma or jnana or yoga. And these were very well-wishing friends, but one after the other they would advise me, like one, he's a very nice man, very nice man. I stayed in his house, you know, for 2 weeks. R.D. Agarwal. So even he said, you know, don't criticize others. Just state in a positive way what you want to say about Krishna, about your activities, about your practices, but don't criticize others. And then he even gave the example of the Gaudiya Mutt, which even Prabhupada said was like a bit more active in Madras. So he said, like the Gaudiya Mutt, they have the same philosophy as you do. They chant Hare Krishna like you do. But they don't criticize. And every year they have thousands of people coming to their Janmashtami. So why can't you just be like them? So, is that what Srila Prabhupada wants? You know? But at the same time, so many people were saying the same thing. I started to wonder if I was doing something wrong. You know, maybe Krishna's trying to tell me something. So right when this whole issue was coming to a head, I received a letter from Srila Prabhupada, and like the letters just jumped out of the page, and he said, the fact is, I am the only one in India who is openly criticizing not only demigod worship and impersonalism, but anything that falls short of complete surrender to Krishna. And then he said, my Guru Maharaj never compromised in his preaching, nor will I, nor should any of my students. We must be firmly convinced and declare it boldly that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead and all others are part and parcel servants. And he said, we must declare it boldly that they should not dream of peace and prosperity unless they're prepared to surrender to Krishna as the Supreme Lord. Oh yes, I missed one important phrase. He said, we are firmly convinced. That's what I said. We are firmly convinced that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead and all others are part and parcel servants, and we must declare it boldly. They should not dream of world peace unless they accept Krishna as Supreme Lord.
Yeah, Sindhuruga?
Yes.
He told me this story. He was in Vrindavan in 1977, and his health was deteriorating, and at one point Srila Prabhupada came to the point of not being able to walk by himself to the temple. So for a while, they carried him in a palanquin. So one day, Sindhuruga got to be the palanquin carrier. And as they were coming out the door, he had to reverse his position and be just facing Prabhupada. Prabhupada was sitting in the palanquin, and he was holding the palanquin. And Prabhupada was just, maybe a foot and a half from Sindhuruga. And Prabhupada leaned forward. And he said, practically his nose was touching him, and he said, "Are you convinced?" He was trying to hold both out and make sure he doesn't drop off. And he said, "Are you convinced?" And then Sindhu said, just because this wave of, conviction and his faith just increased like anything. And he understood what Prabhupada wanted for us to be very determined, very firm, unwavering in our
position. I may just add a footnote here, looking at Nityananda Prabhu's facial expressions along the way, that we don't compromise in our philosophy, but we can be, thoughtful in the way we present it. Like, I think it seems obvious now, but in those, during Srila Prabhupada's days, it wasn't so obvious. And maybe among some devotees, it's not so obvious even now. But I asked Srila Prabhupada that, you talk about the scientists and you say, they're rascals, they're bluffing the people, and, we kick them in the face with boots, and we have to expose them. So I said, and he was like, at that time he was like starting BI, and so I said, is that how we should preach, when we meet scientists? The Prabhupada said, no, you should speak like a gentleman. So I don't want it to be misunderstood when Prabhupada tells us, and I even left out the word foolishly, but in his letter, as I remember now, he said, they should not foolishly dream of world peace unless they're prepared to, surrender fully to Krishna, Supreme Lord. So that's the language he uses with us, but we don't necessarily use the same language when we preach to other people. Speak in a very respectful and gentlemanly way, but we don't compromise. And the more, I guess, open a person is, the more direct we can be. Like, I'm thinking of Mr. Sethi, Srila Prabhupada's staunch friend from Bombay. Such a wonderful story. The first time he met Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada asked him, what is your daily schedule? So he said, I get up, I take my bath, I have some tea and toast, I read the newspaper, and I go to work. And Srila Prabhupada said, and what's the difference between you and a pig? Now, that was Srila Prabhupada and that was Mr. Sethi. We can't do that. I mean, we can make the same point, about the purpose of human life, but not in the same language. And another one just shows how intelligent Srila Prabhupada was. The first time Ambarish Prabhu met him, Alfred Ford, the great grandson of Henry Ford, Srila Prabhupada said to him, because obviously, it's a big thing that he was a descendant of Henry Ford and an heir. So Srila Prabhupada said, so I understand you're Henry Ford's grandson. So, yes. And Prabhupada said, and where is Henry Ford now? So, in a very subtle and tactful way, he made a very profound point and took Ambarish completely off of the Bhagavan platform. So That's realization. Actually, there's no substitute for realization. That's why we have to chant very seriously, without offense. We have to study, you know, very seriously and be convinced and have some realization. Then we'll know how to preach to people according to time, place, and circumstance. Yes, Mara.
I was just thinking, Mara, that in one of the ways that maturity you're talking about, that firm, deep maturity that she's about by exhibiting, we sometimes don't think about it, but, you know, he passed through so many adversities in life, and he showed us, you know, how to apply faithful adherence, in his life, in all kinds of situations. Yeah. And if we apply that in our own lives, when we have adversity, rather than stoop down to the political platform and start making political movements within our movement, which is happening all the time in our society. There's always some faction or other trying to, you know. But
Srila
Prabhupada didn't do that. Didn't blame others. The Prabhupada didn't do that. He just kept on going with the favorite description yesterday. Chanting the mantra and the instructions of Bhagavad Gita, not to be disturbed, that it's, you know, success or failure, happiness or defeat or whatever. You know.
That is the most important point. That we are in the material world. There are going to be ups and downs. And whatever it is, we just tolerate and go on with our Krishna consciousness. And we don't blame others, don't blame the movement, don't blame whoever. But we own the problem. We own the problem. We are in the material world because we decided to be here. And if we're going to get out of the material world, we're the ones who have to make the effort. Krishna will help, but we have to make the effort.
Yes. It's pretty much like the medical doctors in an emergency situation. They have such they provide such deep medical care, health care to persons when there is a real emergency, like in a war situation where people actually, bodies are strewn all over the field and the doctors are going in, and all they can think of is, what am I going to do to help this person stay alive? And they do not really care about their own, personal comforts at the time. There's no consideration of personal comfort. Krishna consciousness is so much like that, that we do not care about our personal comforts, our personal achievements and attainments and all the things that materialists or we've been materially conditioned to think about. Rather, we stay focused on providing spiritual care to others, so that they'll become happy in their Krishna consciousness. Somehow they'll make some progress. And so, if we're in that mood, and it seems like Srila Prabhupada is always in that mood, whenever he spoke, that's why everything sounded so profound, because the love in his heart would just would come forth, it would become very apparent to anybody listening that this person was very, very, very caring, very loving of every person, what to speak of persons, living entities that he actually came in contact with. And so, so when he makes those statements, those very powerful statements, like you say, those statements are then understood well by those who are sincere. Of course, the others will always, there's always going to be people who are going to bark, like dogs bark in the street, and they could bark, it's their nature to bark. But the others who are sincere, they could easily see that the Srila Prabhupada was saying something very profound, very, very real, very true, not that he was trying to declare his position in terms of spirituality and soul spiritual power.
Yeah, that's also a very good point. That, as Srila Prabhupada said, that criticism offered with sympathy is more likely to be accepted. So even though he criticized, and he may have criticized in strong language, but anyone who knew Srila Prabhupada could understand that he was doing it out of love for their benefit, not for any personal benefit of his in any gross or subtle way. So again, we come back to purity, chanting, chanting and purity, and becoming pure, and having that mood, you know, that it is an emergency, it is a crisis.
Urgency.
Yes, urgency. Urgency. And we have to just save them before they die. Thank you all very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Tagore Swami Maharaj. Guru Dev.